right, so here we go. We start our own recording as well. Oops, is the wrong button. There we go.
This conference is being recorded.
So here we are, worldwide live through BBS Radio Online and being recorded on our own recorder. It is a Monday, July the 25th, 2016, and it is the fourth Monday of the month. That means that tonight's call will be taken care of by our wonderful friend Marilyn Lawrence. Before I give her the mic, let me first turn the dings off. All right, so here we are, ready to go. What I will do first is call in the light, do the invocation to create a, what shall I say, a relaxed and a connected space for us to gather in and to talk in. So if you are comfortably seated, we ask our dear Father, Mother, God, the one infinite source of all creation, for the presence of the love and light to surround and protect each person here. And we ask for any negativity to be taken to the highest realms of love, light, and transmuted for the highest good of all concerned. We now envision ourselves in the flow of energy which is radiating from the center of the universe, moving through the galaxies, through the Milky Way, through the solar system, through the outer energy fields of planet Earth, through our bodies and anchoring it to the center of Mother Earth. Can you feel the connection? Right now, we invoke a group energy connection amongst all of us who are present, while we maintain the sovereign integrity of our individual souls, and we invite those sources that are positive, which provide service to others, and honor the law of one to join with us and create a protected space that only the positive has access to, and anything not of that nature must leave now. And I'm very glad to be here. I know that Marilyn Lawrence has a wonderful guest tonight. And Marilyn, thanks. Here is the mic. It is your call.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
All right. Well, this is a call that I have been waiting excitedly to do for several months. And I know that all of you have heard this voice on the other end of the line on Sundays saying, I'm here, I'm in Uganda. And so tonight we have with us Carolyn Sabin, who is that voice. And
all callers are muted and they can unmute themselves.
And I've been having really an exciting visiting time with her, and we're just extending it for tonight. So I'd like to welcome Carolyn Sabin. Carolyn, are you here?
Oh, hold on 1 second. Sorry, I just
muted.
I did star six. Okay,
so that
awesome.
Okay, great. Well, I'm so glad that we could have this time together, and I thank all of you for calling in and being our audience. So, Carolyn, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What kind of work did you do before you went to Uganda, and what hobbies or family? Tell us about you.
Sure. Well, I just had a birthday yesterday. I made it to 76.
Yay!
And since I was almost killed 5 years ago, this is a good one. And, hey, I'm still alive.
Well, I guess so.
And I'm grateful that I am. I love being alive. I love living. I love the work that I do. I love my family and all the people that I know. I just feel... I don't ever say I'm lucky. I say I'm blessed because I believe I am.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I retired 11 years ago, and I retired from teaching at CSUMB, which is California State University at Monterey Bay. And before that, I was an instructional designer. I worked at Lockheed Missiles and Space Company, and it's not that anymore. It's now Lockheed Martin. But it's one of the big defense companies, and Lockheed has one customer, and that's it. You know how companies have a lot of customers? Not Lockheed. And it's all the military. Doesn't matter if it's Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, that's one customer. And Lockheed does some good work. They put out things that go out in space. And if you've seen some of the space things, you know, when they get out there, they have this thing that opens up and it collects sunlight for energy for it to run. That's from Lockheed.
What is an instructional designer?
An instructional designer is a person or training or profession where you take information and you analyze it from many different directions, and then you design it to fit a specific audience so that they can learn from it.
Ah, so you were teaching even then, huh?
Well, I was designing teaching. So I didn't teach until after I left someplace else and then looked around and said, oh, I don't think I want to teach. I don't want to be in academia. It's too complicated. And the person who was the chairman of my second master's degree just took my resume and took it in and said, you've got a job.
Ah, all right.
Okay.
Well,
so,
what were some
before
of the...
that, I was an artist. I was a potter and a glass blower. I was married very young. I don't recommend it at all. But I was 16 when I got married, and 16 when I had my first daughter. And then I had two more, and then it was not a marriage. It was just pretend. So I ended it and then didn't have any money. And since I hadn't finished high school, I just knew I had to put myself through school. And my former husband was not enthusiastic about paying child support. He never paid alimony, but he didn't like to pay child support. So he paid sometimes half of it. I was so happy when Clinton was running and talking about deadbeat dads, and by that time it was too late to do any good. My kids were always, and that was fine. But so I just worked lots of jobs and put myself through school, and I didn't know that when I was doing that I was role modeling for my own children. When they got into high school, and I said, well, what do you think you'll do after high school? And they said, what do you mean? We're going to go to college. That's what you did.
All right.
And so they worked hard, and they got really good grades, so they got scholarships. They went to good schools. They graduated, found wonderful men to marry, and they're still married to them. And they all have children. They all have wonderful children. They're great parents, great wives, great mothers, and they have great jobs. They do good work for this planet. And
great.
I'm just wonderfully proud of them. And then altogether, I have 8 grandchildren. The last one was adopted from China about 5.5 years ago. And she's coming along just fine.
How old was she when she was adopted?
Well, she was 8.5 because my daughter and her husband were too old to adopt a baby. China wouldn't let them. And they said, that's fine. We don't need to do diapers in the middle of the night feedings. We've already done that. And so they had a good adoption agency, and they found a girl that they fell in love with her. And they went over and got her, and they took the whole family over. So everybody met her right in the beginning. Her name is Sophia. And she was thrown away at 3 days old. And that's not unusual in China.
That's the one child per family law, isn't it? That does that.
No, it's she was a girl.
And our
society is very different from in China. If you're a girl and you grow up and get married, you go to your husband's house and you take care of his parents. And if someone's going to take care of your parents, it has to be a son who has a wife, because girls are not allowed to do that. They have to go to their son's family and take care of his family. And so, even though after their civil war, the government promised that they were going to change it and they were going to have something like Social Security so that people, when they were old, would have money and wouldn't die without help, it didn't really happen. And so it's called female infanticide. It's where you throw them away. And frequently they're thrown away in the woods and the animals eat them. This child was put in a house behind some stairs. Somebody heard her cry, and they took her to an orphanage. Fortunately, the orphanage that they took her to, there was this wonderful woman who took one look at this baby and said, "I know how to work with you," because she had a cleft palate. And if you don't know that, you see pictures of trying to raise money for helping children, and they have these discolored bumps for lips.
Mm-hmm.
And what doesn't show is that on the inside of their mouth, there's a hole in the roof of their mouth. So if you give an infant who has a cleft palate, all the milk that this child is trying to swallow goes right into her lungs and her sinuses, and of course she dies.
Well, she was meant to come to your family.
She was meant to stay alive, and she still is. And whoever this wonderful woman was, we'll never know, because when she was five, she was given to a foster parents, and they had seven other children, so they had eight all together.
Mm-hmm.
And when my daughter and her husband got her home, and my daughter and her husband lived in China for 7 years, and they both speak, read, and write Chinese, so they could talk to her and explain to her what things were. So she was never afraid.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes. So this little girl, somebody came to her foster home and asked, did anyone want to be adopted? And she, with all this amazing courage, she raised her hand and said, yes, I think I would. And so she was put on the list, and when my family saw her picture, they said, that's it. That's who we want. And so went over and got her, and she was when she was far out away from Beijing, so they had to take a plane to get to Beijing. And she got in the plane, and she said, are we going to America? She got off, and she said, is this America? And then they had to wait and get on the plane again and then go to America. And this brave child has had at least six or seven surgeries, including bone grafting, when they redid the surgery in her mouth, on her roof of the mouth. And bone grafting is very painful. And this little girl, she's 14, almost 15 now, she is full of courage. And they explained to her what's going to happen and what she'll have to do and how she has to be careful. And she's just so brave. She's had so many surgeries, and she just, you know, and she came here, foreign country, didn't know a single word of English. Fortunately, she had her now adopted parents that could talk to her and explain things.
Could help her, right.
And I go visit, and frequently when I visit, I end up at dinner table sitting next to her. And she'll say things like, I'm a Chinese American. We have a lot of food here.
Well, it sounds like your family is worldwide already.
I haven't told you about my daughter is a medical economist. She works in India, China, Vietnam, Guatemala, and 4 to 6 different countries in Africa. She works on interventions for medical things. Like she worked on this intervention for children dying. So they went in and looked at maps of, and both in Africa and in many parts of Asia, there are more people in villages than in towns. And the towns frequently have no water, no electricity, no school. And it's hard to live there, very hard life.
Yeah, so, it would be. Well, tell us how you came to work in Uganda. How did you come to pick there or be there?
Well, I was traveling with my daughter, because every once in a while she'll say, Mom, why did you come to Vietnam with me? I thought, oh, sure. And so my mother had died, and I was thinking about what I was going to do, and I had always thought I would end up in the Peace Corps. And so I said, well, I've been thinking of going to the Peace Corps to South America because I'll still be fairly close to my family. And she said, what? You'll go away for 2 years at a time? Of course, this was over 11 years ago, and my grandchildren were much younger then. And I said, oh, I don't need to be gone for 2 years. And she said, well, I know a place where they have an orphanage, and I think you'd love it there. And so she gave me the name of the director, and I wrote to him, and I ended up volunteering to go there and went back a third time. But by the time I got back the third time, it was not a good place for me any longer. And I had found another place working for an NGO that also worked with orphans. And I didn't know very much about Uganda when I first went over there. I didn't know that they say that AIDS started in Africa, in Uganda, in Africa, and it decimated the country. For a long time, the government would say, no, we don't have any orphanages here because we don't need them. People take care of their own in this country. Well, not if they're dead. And if the parents and grandparents and all the aunts and uncles and cousins are dead, who will take care of these children? And so that's how this particular orphanage was started. It started out to be a hospice and just taking kids off the street because they had no one and they were dying on the street. But it turned out that if you give these kids with AIDS good food, good water, love and affection, that they start living. And so the government recognized that that was necessary, and there are now orphanages allowed there. So anyway, I was teaching writing at this NGO. I had moved from a town way outside of Masaka. I mean, outside of Kampala. Kampala is the capital. And I was working in a town called Masaka. So I ended up working in the capital. And in this NGO, I was teaching writing. And then some of my students kept saying things like, you need to come to our school. Oh, okay. So I did, and I met they don't call them principals, they call head teachers. So I met the head teachers and became friends and was invited to come and teach writing in the schools. And I ended up liking that better than working for the NGO, because what I was doing for the NGO was providing the kids with a fun, creative writing experience. But in school, I'm teaching writing,
mm-hmm.
and my kids are learning writing, and they're doing very well. So I stayed there. I just started doing that more and more, and then sort of transitioned out of the NGO and just started. Then, three or four years ago, I can't remember exactly, from the writings of my students, I found out they were beaten. It wasn't just my students, it was all the students. So when I talked to my friends, I found out that they beat in every school. So I collected
This was for discipline or for not showing up, or why were they beating them?
They shouldn't beat them at all, but they beat them for anything they can think of. You talked in class, you didn't walk in exactly on time. You didn't have your clothes tucked in like they're supposed to be.
Wow.
You talk to a fellow student. It doesn't matter. You're beaten. All the teachers were beaten. I've talked to my teachers. I know they were all badly beaten in school. And they think that's what they're supposed to do. So I took my students' writings about their experiences to the head teacher, and I said, Olivia, did you know that students are being beaten? And she said, no, I forbid it. I don't allow it, and they promised me they won't. And I said, oh. And I just set the stack of writings on her desk, and she started reading them, one after another. And after about six or seven writings, she put her head on her desk and said, no, I see it's true, but I can't stand it. I forbid them. They promised me they won't. I've done everything I know how to do. I don't know what to do. And, you know, Americans, we'll try anything, some of us. And so I asked her if she would help me teach the teachers positive discipline so they'd stop eating. And she looked at me, and she said, of course. So we did. And less than 2 months later, there were no beatings anymore.
Wow.
But what we didn't know is that as soon as the teachers told their students no more beatings, and then they didn't, and almost immediately the students started testing them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do this and I'd get bitten, so I'm gonna beaten. I'm gonna do it, and they would do it, and they wouldn't get beaten. And we as parents know that we're tested all the time from our kids at every age. And the kids wanted to know, are you telling the truth? Did you lie? Can I trust you? Will mm-hmm. you really not beat me? And all of my wonderful teachers passed the tests of the students.
Wow.
So now when I say to my students that I'm teaching the class, and I say, has anybody been beaten in the last 2 weeks? And I hear in unison, no. And I smile and say, oh, good. Has anybody in the last 6 to 8 weeks been beaten? And it gets really quiet. And then somebody will lean forward and say, oh, no, teacher. We have positive discipline here.
Now, was this a program that you devised yourself, or is it
no.
a program that was already done?
It's been already done, and it's done all over, and you can go buy a dozen different books on it. And so I went online and found out more about it, and then I figured out how to construct some classes so that we could teach the teachers this, and we did. And they learned, and they loved it. And they've never said to me, but I feel very strongly that they stopped beating their own children also.
Oh, what
they
a
saw the results.
What
they,
a difference one person can make. What
everywhere,
a difference.
That's all it takes. And
yeah.
And now I have asked my wonderful teachers if we can teach the parents of all these students positive discipline so no child at home or at school will ever be beaten again. And, of course, these teachers stepped up to it. So when I get back in September, guess what we're doing?
All right. Now, I know that you have a plan going forward for this work. Can you share that with us?
Well, I have some lessons, that I want the teachers to redesign to fit the parents. They know the parents better than I do. And then we'll divide the work among each other, and we will schedule the meetings. We will have the parents come in, and we will present the lessons, and we will teach the classes. There's one thing in particular that isn't in the positive discipline data that I want to make. It's a point I want to make to especially the fathers. And that's that we know what bullies are. And in my country, we study things like that, and we know that bullies are cowards because they never pick on anyone their own size or their own age. They always pick on someone who's smaller and younger than they are, and they beat them up. And that's what you call a coward. And what we want, what we truly want out of these lessons is for all parents to recognize that it is time for bullying in adults to stop so that all Ugandan men can stand up with pride and be like other men in other countries that never beat a wife or a child.
Oh.
And I've been told that when I give that talk, that I have to have an armed, that means with a rifle, an armed guard sitting there to guarantee that we'll all be safe. And I said, of course I will. And, you know, when we designed that lesson, because nobody wants to do that, and I volunteered, okay, I'll do it. But we will have some exercises, and we will have some discussions, and then we'll talk about anger management and how critical it is for this whole thing of positive discipline.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to be in a third world country, actually working there?
Well, because I'm a volunteer, I don't get fired.
Uh-huh. So can you walk on the streets? We every now and then hear a news story about trouble in Uganda. Do you walk on the streets? Do you have a guard?
Yes, I do.
How do you shop?
I have a caretaker. After the accident, when I almost died, my three daughters, as incredibly wonderful as they are, they said, no, you're not going back. It's not safe. And I said, hey, come on, I'm the mother. I get to do this. They said, no. And I said, yes. And finally, I wised up and said, what do I need to do so that you feel better about me being over there? And my second daughter said, one, you get a caretaker, and two, you get travel insurance, because it cost over $70,000 to medevac you from Uganda to England, and your insurance didn't pay for all of it.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I don't travel there without travel insurance, and my insurance means I usually am covered for $1 million for medevacking, which means that if I'm seriously injured, which I don't expect, then I could go to several different places. I could be medevaced from here to there to different experts,
mm-hmm.
and then still get home alive and well.
Yeah.
And I have a caretaker who meets me at the airport when I fly in and takes me to where I rent a room, the house where I rent a room, and he leaves and comes back the next day. He takes care of his mother, who has had cancer, and he has to be there every single night because he gets up at 4 a.m. to give her medication and a shot. And he's gotten so good at giving her shots that she doesn't even wake up anymore, which is getting really good.
Uh-huh.
And then he wakes up in the morning. He has to go back to bed and sleep, and wakes up in the morning and comes over to where I live, and then we work together. He takes me to every meeting or class that I go to. I'm not allowed, and I promise him that I won't leave that area. There's a big fence around it, and I won't leave. I won't go outside the fence because I'm not safe, and I won't leave unless he's there. And if I'm there, and if he's there, and I ask him to take me for a walk, so because I need that, then he says, sure, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And he watches everything that comes my way. I am a target over there because I'm white.
Mm-hmm. So does he take you shopping? What is shopping like?
Oh.
What kind of food do they have?
Well, they, yes, he takes me shopping and won't let me carry anything. I do this at home and I can carry this. Okay. And, they have all kinds of things. They don't have the things that we have, of course, but they have enough that you can get whatever you want. What I had to learn the hard way is that the soil in Uganda was depleted decades ago. And that means that all the vegetables rot very fast. And that means that even if you cook them and eat them before they're rotten, they're still not as nutritious as organic foods here are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take extra things. Like I take, I don't know how many people buy the greens that are powdered, and you look at what all's in them, and it's like collards and spinach and kale and, you know, all this green stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's powdered, and you just stir it up and drink it. And so I take that, and I take some for me and some for my caretaker. But this, because the soils are depleted, the food is not as nutritious as it is here and in other places. The meat is very good. They do not do what they do in America to beef. They don't put it in these lots where they feed them corn, which is bad for them, and make them fat, so that when you buy this meat, it looks like meat used to look like when I was growing up, not marbled fat. And it also doesn't have growth hormones in it or antibiotics. And it tastes good. It's very good meat, very good. It's tough. You have to cook it a while. It doesn't, you know, if you don't have fat marbled through beef, then it cooks differently.
Is the general population well fed?
No, because of poverty. It's a terribly, terribly impoverished country. There aren't enough jobs, and most jobs don't pay enough to live on. There's a lot of theft in Uganda. The MPs, and that means the members of parliament, are horribly corrupt, as is the president, as are the police, as are the banks. And you, when you go to the stores, you watch everything that's rung up, because it will accidentally hit the wrong price. So you watch.
And then you have to pay for it anyway if it gets rung up.
If you don't pay attention, you pay more, yes.
Yes, yeah.
And there are people who are starting to grow more of their own food, and so they have better food. It's a very harsh way of life for most people.
Do you have electricity and water, everything that you need there?
We have electricity that goes off all the time. Never announced, and you call in, and they don't answer the phone. And if they do answer, if they just put a recording on that says, "We're experiencing difficulties right now," click.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes off. Hardly a week goes by without the power going off. And it can go off at the most inopportune time. Like if you're cooking and you need electricity to run your beaters or something, you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have everything thawing in your freezer.
Yeah, there's never an opportune time for the electricity to go out. Well,
the water is polluted. It's very bad water. So they have a thing. There were some Americans that came over, and they sort of invented this thing called a Tiva. And it is a plastic big garbage can, and then at the bottom they have a mound of special sand. It's actually quartz rock that was ground up. And then there's a special cloth over that, and then it's anchored in. And you pour this water in, and when it comes out of the spigot, it is purified water. You can drink it. I am highly sensitive to the impurities in the water there. I get sick. If I were to go have a glass of the sink water, you know, right out of the faucet,
mm-hmm.
within an hour I would be throwing up and I'd have diarrhea. And it would last for at least two days. So I have a Tiva, but I also have another filtering thing that I take over. And I double filter the water. And I never get sick anymore.
Wow, what a gift.
Yes.
Maybe we need to know about that for preparations for over here, to be a prepper.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could have better water? Over there, I have water without any chlorine or fluoride in it, and it's better for us that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you came back this last time, one of the things that you mentioned was your work with sharing the Man Who Walked book. And I wonder if you would tell us about that, and then tell us about your having a special connection to it.
Well, has everybody on the line read the book or read part of it?
I don't know. I imagine they're familiar with it. It's Dr. Friedman's book,
yes.
The Man Who Walked with Jesus, that she's going to be talking about.
Well, I had a copy of the book that was given to me by him, and Wynn was very generous to mail it to me, several copies, and I took it with me, and I started reading it to the people that I live in the house with, and I realized that that's not enough. And so I had a friend of mine gather some more people so that we started out with 10 people reading this book. And she came over and I had fixed a bunch of food. And I fed them first. And I had a lot of food, so they ate a lot and then they couldn't move. So then they had to sit there and listen. And they loved the book. So I read for a good while, about an hour, and then I pointed to the paragraph where we were, and I handed it to somebody else and said, would you like to read? And if that person didn't want to read, I would have gone to the next. But the first person I handed the book to and asked if they wanted to read said, sure. And that person read for half an hour and got tired, and the next person read. And everybody was thrilled. And if you read that book for 2 hours, you've gone quite a ways. So you know already what happened in the beginning is how Dr. Friedman was called by Yeshua to come and rewrite this book. And Yeshua is the name that he was called when he was 2,000 years ago, when he was on this planet. And that's Aramaic for Jesus. But they didn't call him Jesus. They called him Yeshua, then Joseph. His father's name. So, you know, like we have a first and last name. His
mm-hmm.
last name was Ben Joseph. And so you're quite into it, and you know that this person was working as a guard for Rome, and that's how he made his money, and he was had a good deal of money. He was not poor at all. And that this first, right there in the first pages of this, he sees a group of people rocking towards him, and this tall man strides over to him and says, follow me. And he was shocked. And so he talked to him for a little bit and invited him to his house for dinner. And that's how it started. That's how his becoming a real disciple started. And right there, you're into it, and you're so far into it, and you learned enough about this man named Yeshua. And it's explained that that's aromatic for what later became Jesus. But Jesus didn't speak English. He spoke Aramaic and Hebrew. And he spoke other languages too. And he was schooled in a scene school, E-S-S-E-E-N or E-N-E, I have to look it up. And you can read about what an Essene school was and how it worked. And then they explain it in the book, so you get a broader vision of this wonderful school that both his mother and father went to, and he went to. And you just get into the book more and more. And after this first night reading this book, there was this last person who hadn't gone with the rest of the group. They're all in the living room, or sitting room, they call it, getting their gathering their bags and everything, getting ready to walk out the door, and he looked at me and he said, "This was the truth, wasn't it?" And I said, "I believe it is the truth." And he said, "And we know that the Bible says, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." And I gave him a big smile, and I said, "Yes." And he said, "But I am feeling free." And I said, "Yes, I know. So do I now." And, of course, he would never miss a meeting. So that's how our meeting started. They want more, they want more, they want more. And I purchased copies so that each of the 10 people that finish and read the book, I can give it to them, a digital copy of the book, and ask them, each person, to meet with 10, gather together 10 friends and read to them and have them read part, you know, like I do, just share the reading, so that there will be 10, each person will teach or read the whole book to 10 people.
Wow, that is really amazing.
And, well, let me explain the math if I can. Math is not my strong suit, so 10 times 10 is 100, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when each of these 10 people teach 10 people, that will be 100, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if 100 people teach 10 people, 100 times 10 is what? It's 1,000.
1,000, uh-huh.
And if 1,000 people teach 10, you have 10,000, right?
Right.
And
wow.
If 10,000 teach 10 people, you have 100,000. And when 100,000 people have taught 10 people each, that's 1,000,000. And
wow.
When a million people teach, each person teaches 10 people. That's 10 million, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the plan. And the way it has to work is that I have to have permission for each person that I teach, each of the 10, get a digital copy. And they can give 10 copies out. So digitally, so it's not going to affect, you know, it's not going to take anything away from the people buying the book, but it allows Dr. Friedman's and Jesus's book to reach a huge number of people. And remember that the whole point, the whole purpose is to be free.
To be free.
And you think about the things that are in that book that aren't in the churches. And all of that can go away so that you can break the chains that the churches have on people's minds, the fear of going to hell. Once you read the book and you learn what hell was,
mm-hmm.
And you know that it doesn't exist, and you know that that's baloney. And there, you know, remember, Christ was a very strong man. When he picked that money changer up and threw him across and out of the church and then threw all the tables out, that had an effect, a powerful effect. And there are things that churches do today that if Yeshua were here in those churches, somebody would be thrown across to the parking lot.
I can give
you an example. A very wonderful friend of mine over there was killed by a hospital, as is not unusual. And she and her husband went to a church and had been to a church, going to the same church for 10 years. So when the church went to do the funeral, they charged a fortune for the building, for the parking lot, for the choir, for the ushers, for paying the pastor, and for the rent of the building. If Jesus had been there at that funeral, he would have picked that pastor up. He would have marched him across the parking lot. He would have picked him up and thrown him across the street.
You would not have been happy.
You do not do this in my Father's house. And that's one of the things that churches do. And if you saw the cars that those pastors drive, and you learn where their houses are, where the rich people are, you would be so disappointed. It's not anything the Catholic Church didn't do. It's not anything churches don't do here. But there are limits, and this book can stop those and draw the lines where the limits are.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
the more people have this book, the more freedom we'll have. And, you know, there's no way I can read to 100 people, but I can read, I can finish with my first group, and I can start a second group. And then when I go back in February, March, whatever I get there, I can finish with that second group and start a third group.
Mm-hmm. Well, aren't you going back in September? Are you going back in September?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well,
And I'll be back in December.
What do you, you'll be back here in December, be back in the States. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What would you use some extra money for?
Oh, I desperately need more money, because having the teachers come in at night to teach the parents means that I need to have money for transportation. And I don't have it.
They need transportation to come in.
Yes, because they can't afford to come in twice a day. They come in to teach. They have to go home. They all have families of their own. And then when they come back, they have to have transportation. But there's a little more to that story that I haven't told you. After teaching the parents this September, we start in September. And by December, we should have gotten the parents through the learning of the positive discipline and learning how to pass the test that their own children will give them.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So then we have a lot of maintenance to do, and we have to learn how to do that. And what I what I want to do is, next year when I go back, I want to divide my original teachers, 26 of them, into two groups, 13 each, and have them go to two new schools. And first teach those teachers positive discipline, and then wait a month, and then teach them how to pass their students' test.
Mm-hmm.
And then can stay with them. And then the next term, teach those teachers how to teach their students' parents positive discipline. So in these two new schools, the teachers have been taught, and the parents have been taught, and everybody's passed the test, and now we have a maintenance for how we encourage the parents to maintain positive discipline and share this information with their neighbors. And when I get back in September and we first teach the parents positive discipline, then I come back here and I go back. When I go back in February, that's when we teach this group, the original group of parents, you know, my original school's parents, students'
mm-hmm.
parents, then we have to learn how to teach them to encourage others that don't have kids in school yet.
How to do that so that
this idea of not beating gets into neighborhoods. And I do have some ideas for it, and I'll get more ideas from the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So that in all the little neighborhoods, we have these little hotbeds of positive discipline.
Of going and forward, then, going forward. I just think that whole concept of multiplying by teaching one, teaching 10, and then them teaching the others is really a wonderful way to go forward.
And so next year, when I have divided my teachers in half and we're covering two new schools, at the end of the year, those teachers and parents will have been taught and it'll be reinforced. So then the following year, see, now I have three schools. I can divide the three schools in half, and we can take on six schools and first teach positive discipline, then teach pass the test, then teach the parents how to pass the test, and then do all the other work that gets those all those new people in their new neighborhoods. And then
Wynn has offered to allow anyone who would like to support Carolyn in her work in Uganda to make a donation. And on the email that came out today is a button.
It will be later today, tonight. He will send it out.
Oh, okay. So an email will come out, and if you feel so moved to help Carolyn in her complete renovation of Uganda.
this can work. It can work. It can work.
It is working. It is working. And I'm just...
I feel like I'm going to cry. Thank you so much.
I'm just so thrilled to hear your story and to have you share it with everyone.
Well, thank you. But let me finish just this little bit. After six schools, the next year, 12. The next year, 24, and the next year, 48. And after 48, the government will step in and say, what's going on here? We need this in every school in this country. And I already have somebody who has agreed to go negotiate with the government to get my first original teachers paid to take this positive discipline to the country.
Countrywide.
Yes.
Oh, that's remarkable. And we certainly will put this project and you and all of your students and teachers in the light as we go forward.
And so, I should tell you, I have to sorry to mail and throw it in, but this is not my idea. I know because of my prayers that when these ideas come to me, I say, thank you, that's it.
Yes,
and I'm just grateful that I'm not doing this alone. And you know what it's like to not be alone, and you know what it's like to have Ra and Elohim.
When did you get off the air?
Mm-hmm.
And Mother, Father, God, because that's what Yeshua calls. And the Holy Spirit and Yeshua himself. It's time for a change. Yeshua was right when he had Uncle Terry, Dr. Matthew, Dr. Friedman, write this book. This book can change people, whole neighborhoods.
It can, and we're out of time. I'm so sorry.
Heist,
do we have time for the closing?
Yes, certainly. So, yeah, thank you all so much. And we are still on the air currently, so I want to say in the light and love of the One Infinite Creator, we now close tonight's beautiful session. We draw the love, light, energy back to ourselves, into our hearts, and we send love and gratitude to those positive beings on the other side of the veil that join us during these sessions. We ask for blessings for those attending these calls with help and assistance for all things that we have in their minds, surrounded by love light. And we will always honor the principles of for the highest good of all concerned and free will. We are so glad to be of service. We thank you and thank you and thank you.
And thank you. And thank you, everybody. Be sure to check out the donation button if you feel like you'd like to help Carolyn in her work in Uganda. And
thank you so much.
And please put it in the light every time you think of it.
The email will come out in about an hour or so.
Going forward.
All callers are muted and they can unmute themselves.
Oops, wrong button. Here we go.
All callers are unmuted.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
God bless.
Love life for everyone.